Lately, I've been talking about topics in relation to Prabhupada rather than chronologically remembering. So now I'm trying to think of another topic because chronologically, in the later years, we're up to like 1975 now, my direct association with Prabhupada at that time was less. And the reason is that Prabhupada was more stationary in the early days, especially in Los Angeles. And I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, but as the movement progressed, he traveled more because it got bigger. So as you might know, in the early days, there weren't many temples, so there weren't that many places to go. And generally he was only going where there was temples. He wasn't the one who was opening the temples. His disciples were opening temples. And so as we opened more temples, then he had more places to travel. And as he had more places to travel, then he was staying less at each place. Whereas I had mentioned that in 1972, Prabhupada had spent 3 months in L.A. and I was there, I believe, the whole time. And then I had moved to San Diego, and then I had moved back to Los Angeles in 1975, and then Prabhupada came, but it was only a week. So from 3 months, it dwindled down to 1 week because he had so many places to go. So my association also dwindled a little bit. In 1975, it was the second International Mayapur Festival. And the unique thing about that festival is that Prabhupada, just as we would all go there, Prabhupada would attend the festival. So it was a 5-week festival, 3 months, excuse me, 3 weeks in Mayapur and 2 weeks in Vrindavan, and all the devotees would go first to Mayapur, and Prabhupada was there, and he'd give class every day. And then a select few would go on morning walks and tell us what Prabhupada said on the morning walks. And then we would all go to Vrindavan, and Prabhupada would be there in Vrindavan, and he would be giving class every day. And it was in that year that the Krishna Balaram temple was opened. That was the first year I went to India. It was 1975, and in that year, Krishna Balaram temple was opened. So we got to spend 2 weeks with Prabhupada opening the Krishna Balaram temple. And one of the unique items of Prabhupada opening that temple is he did the first arti, and that was the first time, unless you joined in 1966, you wouldn't have seen Prabhupada doing arti. So it was the first time we saw him do arti, and the last time also. So that was unique, and there's a picture of Prabhupada doing arti on the Krishna Balaram altar. If you see a picture of Prabhupada doing arti standing up, we've seen, there are pictures of Prabhupada at 26 Second Avenue, he was sitting down doing arti. I don't know if it was a full arti, but since that time he never did arti, never had an occasion. And so for the opening of Krishna Balaram temple, he did arti, and there's a picture of it. And then after Prabhupada did arti, he walked off the altar, which in the Krishna Balaram temple means he would just, not entirely off the altar, there's the entire altar is raised, but he walked a little bit away from the deities and turned towards the audience, towards the temple, and turned around, and he gave a talk about the installation of Krishna Balaram while he was sitting on the altar, I mean standing on the altar after the arti. So at the end of, they had the 30th anniversary celebration of the opening of Krishna Balaram Mandir, and about 100 Prabhupada disciples came, and they just had that March 24th through 28th to commemorate the opening of that and the occasion. So I was there for that occasion. And what Prabhupada did was he had hired some of the local Brahmins to do the deity installation. And in the way they do the deity installation, according to what is acceptable standard. Not according to Vaishnava standard, but what is according to the standards, general standards, which would be acceptable within Vrindavan or perhaps Hinduism in general. The installation of the deity is a long, drawn-out process. It can go on for 2 days. I don't remember it going on for 2 days. I remember it going on for maybe a half a day in Vrindavan. And so there's a lot of rituals that are done. Lots and lots of rituals. And pujas and lots of mantras. Right? When we installed deities here in Mauritius, it was a two-day affair. And the interesting thing about our installation here, which was 1983, is that the same pandit Brahmins who installed Krishna Balaram were actually living here in Vrindavan, living here in Mauritius at that time, and they installed the deities here, the same people. But in any case, there were all these rituals going on, and at one point I saw that they were having Prabhupada, they were like putting, from what I remember, putting markings on his hands or his wrists and having him chant mantras and throw grains. And in the ceremony, and Prabhupada was just basically sitting there almost alone while these other arrangements were being made to install the deities. That was one of the arrangements that he, as the founder of Acharya, would have to do some kind of puja type. So I was just watching it, and I was sitting next to Prabhupada, watching them do the pujas. And basically, from my perspective, it just looked like Prabhupada was tolerating it, and he was kind of observing what they were doing. But he looked kind of, not kind of, he was basically disinterested, and it didn't seem by looking at him that he was giving much importance to it. Not 40th anniversary, well, 200 disciples, whoa, multiply that. Amazing. Krishna Kirtan, where do we get the recordings? Where are they posted? We want to hear them. So I was looking at Prabhupada, and I kind of sensed that this was something that we as Vaishnavas wouldn't do, because I'd never seen devotees do it. And the look on Prabhupada's face was kind of like, we have to do this, so I will do it, but I'm not really interested in it. I didn't really know what was going on. It was the first deity installation I had seen in India. I didn't. But I also had the sense that there were a lot of things going on that we had never done before in ISKCON when we installed deities. Because I had been to the installation of two deities, both Los Angeles, Rukmini Dwarkadish, and Radha Giridhari in San Diego. So I had known what we do as deity installation, and what was going on here in the installation of Krishna Balaram was quite elaborate, and I'd never seen anything like it. And the things they were doing for Prabhupada, I could sense were extravagant, extraordinary, not really something we would do, although I didn't really understand it. It just, that sense I got, just because there were so many things that they were doing, little pujas, throw this rice, throw this water, chant this mantra. And it just didn't seem like something that was part of our normal installation of deities in Vaishnava culture. So, so as I was looking at Prabhupada, it kind of looked like, how should I describe it, that if you have to go through a ritual in which it's necessary to do, for whatever reason, it's necessary, but you don't feel it's important, but you just tolerate it because of, let's say, family relationships or some relationships. Kind of like maybe you go it's somebody's birthday, your cousin's birthday, and your family's going, and so you go, and they're doing so many things, and you're not really interested, but you just have to be there as an etiquette. So that was the impression I got, and I didn't understand it. But then Prabhupada later described it, and so I think Chaitanya Charitamrita, perhaps, maybe Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, or Chaitanya Charitamrita, he described the installation. And he described all the puja and the samskaras that were going on. And then he said he didn't consider those important. And during that time, Prabhupada had us chant, do kirtan. And then Prabhupada said that the real installation was the kirtan, the real puja, the real samskara, the important thing was the kirtan. And then later on he explained that Jiva Goswami said, because the holy name is the religion of this age, that whenever you do anything, it must be accompanied by chanting of the holy name, and that makes it complete. So then Jiva Goswami said, if you install deities or you do puja, there always has to be chanting, or any ceremony, there always has to be chanting of the holy name, because without chanting of the holy name, no function, no ceremony is complete. And Bhagavad Gita says also there should be distribution of prasadam. So last week in class, I don't know, I think many of you weren't able to hear the class, but a devotee related that when Prabhupada was here in Mauritius, that they asked him, how will we be successful in spreading Krishna consciousness? And Prabhupada said, you distribute the holy name and you distribute prasadam, and then you'll be successful. So last weekend, there was a weekend before last, there was Kirtan Mela, and so it was a huge success, and it was just kirtan and prasadam, and everyone was saying it was the best festival we've ever had. And so it's interesting. What we experienced as the best festival was kirtan and prasadam. There's no dancing, no drama, no this or that. Of course, I'm not minimizing that. I'm just saying how everybody was so impressed and moved by the festival, which was predominantly kirtan. So anyway, the point I'm making is my sense of Prabhupada's tolerating the ritual was correct, just by seeing the expression on his face. That he, and then you might ask, well, why did Prabhupada tolerate the ritual? And it's very interesting why he tolerated, why he did it. And maybe you won't understand this, but we have to explain it. That Prabhupada had one of the problems that Prabhupada had in spreading Krishna consciousness in India initially was getting people to accept that his devotees, his disciples, were actually Vaishnavas bona fide, and that they could be initiated as Brahmins. So Prabhupada was calling us Vaishnavas, and he was initiating us as Brahmins, and he was giving us Brahmin threads. But there was a class of people, amazingly, even some Vaishnavas, good Vaishnavas, who believed that we could not become Brahmins or Vaishnavas because we were born outside of India and we were born outside of Vedic culture. And we were known as mlechas, meaning in yavanas. And mlechas in yavanas means meat eaters and those outside of Vedic culture. So according to strict Hindu Brahminical understanding, which is incorrect, unless you're born in a Brahminical family, you can't be trained. And if you're born an American, there's no question that you're born in a Brahminical family, because there are no Brahmins in America, all less than Shudra, outside Vedic culture. Within Vedic culture, you'll be Shudra or Vaishya, Kshatriya or Brahmin. But if you're born outside of Vedic culture, you won't be any of those. And so there was Anyway, this was one thing Prabhupada had to contend with, that people didn't believe that his devotees were bona fide. So he also understood that to install the deities, he had to install the deities with ceremonies and procedures, samskaras and pujas, that were acceptable to the local people in Vrindavan, otherwise they wouldn't accept the temple as bona fide. And so, in order that the temple was established as a bona fide temple and now one of the main temples in Vrindavan, most popular, or one of the most popular, he had to install deities according to the local standards which were acceptable. And so you might think, well, was that a compromise? Was that a compromise? And no, it's not a compromise, because, well, you could say Prabhupada was willing to make a compromise if it helped spread Krishna consciousness. So generally, we saw that Prabhupada, he never compromised his principles. But you have to understand what were Prabhupada's principles to understand if he compromised them. So I'll tell a story which will illustrate, I think, more clearly that Prabhupada always stuck to his principles, even if it looked like he compromised them. Now, one of the most graphic stories, which I may have told before, but it's worth telling again, and it's so instructive, is that Prabhupada had a disciple who created a party of brahmacharis, and they had many buses and many vans, and they were, I believe at that time, when 1975, they were the, or 1976, they were the largest book distribution party in the world. So I don't know how many devotees in total, but they're, you know, close to 100, maybe more, 80 to 120. I wasn't on the party, so I don't know. I was around the party. And many, many of the brahmacharis in the temples were attracted to the party because it was just brahmacharis and sannyasis. And so there was some propaganda going around when they would visit temples that if you stay in the temple as a brahmachari, you'll just get married, and so better you come travel with the sannyasis and other brahmacharis, which if you were a brahmachari was an attractive idea. So it actually had become a problem because of this kind of encouragement, many of the brahmacharis were leaving temples, and it had become such a problem that in Mayapur, it must have been 1976 as far as I know, it had become such a problem that many of the temple presidents were complaining about it, and the complaints came to Prabhupada. And devotees were, the temple presidents, many other devotees were very, very upset, because if their brahmacharis left the temple, then how are they going to run the temple? And although Prabhupada agreed in principle that a brahmachari should travel with sannyasi, ideally, that would be great, he didn't agree that they should be coerced out of the temple because they were needed in the temple. So it doesn't sound like a big problem, I guess, but actually it was a huge problem because I think the temple presidents felt that if it continued that way, gradually most of the brahmacharis in every temple, at least in America, would leave the temples, and so the temples wouldn't be able to run. Because in those days, the vast majority of devotees were brahmacharis, and if all the brahmacharis left the temple, you wouldn't have many devotees. So Prabhupada was really concerned about this, and he was very concerned about the leader, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who was the leader of this party, who was responsible for basically building up this party and developing the book distribution to this level. And no, he was an expert manager, and nobody aside from him would be able to do this. So he was responsible for building up the party and responsible for maintaining the party. And so it was kind of a dilemma because Prabhupada, you know, spoke to him about it and he was upset with him. And I don't think Prabhupada, I don't know if Prabhupada trusted him in that position, because I think he thought that this problem would continue and it was creating a faction between brahmacharis and grihasthas. And whenever there was a faction, potential faction being created, Prabhupada would do whatever was necessary to prevent it. He always tried to keep us unified, and at least I personally noticed this, that he would never do and he would never say anything that would fractionalize us, that would divide us. So you'll never see Prabhupada preaching like from the perspective of a renunciate against grihasthas, or taking the side of grihasthas against renunciates, or preaching that one devotee is better than another, one service is better than another. He never did that. I mean, we do that, or at least we used to do that. And we may unconsciously, subconsciously do it. But Prabhupada never did that. On the contrary, if there was potential factions developing because of people taking sides, either as brahmacharis, grihasthas, or temples, challenging one another in an unhealthy way, not working well together like that, he always dissolved it. I noticed that. From my perspective, it seemed that it was a huge concern. And so at this time, it also, from my perspective, seemed to be a huge concern for Prabhupada, because he saw this factionalization, grihasthas against brahmacharis, and of course, temples being withering down and not being able to function. So Prabhupada spoke with this devotee, Timokrishnaraj. Timokrishnaraj was, Prabhupada was heavy with him. And Prabhupada said, we'll give you another example here. And this is another interesting example of how Prabhupada dealt with situations. If a lot of devotees were complaining about somebody, then Prabhupada took that very seriously. And I think this is a really, really important point. Prabhupada was, he would get very upset if a devotee, a leader, was not treating devotees well. They'd really get upset. However that was, it could be something as simple as not providing nice prasadam or sufficient prasadam or good prasadam. Or not providing just sufficient facility to be healthy. Sometimes he wouldn't get upset, but he would just tell them, why, make sure they have these things. So make sure they have enough cloth, make sure they're getting enough rest, make sure they're getting enough milk, make sure the pregnant women are getting enough milk, like that. Prabhupada was concerned. I think he saw us like his children, and especially I think he saw that we were dedicating our lives, so we needed, the leaders must take care of us physically and in all ways, not just spiritually. So whenever devotees weren't being taken well care of, or whenever a leader was causing a disturbance, in this case it wasn't that Timokrishnaraj wasn't taking care of devotees, but it was causing a disturbance for the temple presence, Prabhupada took it very seriously. And he often chastised the leaders for doing that. I would say often, he always did. If he was aware of it, you have to look at it this way. He was entrusting these people to run his movement. And the way Prabhupada, if you see how Prabhupada personally dealt with the devotees, it was full of concern and compassion. And so obviously he wanted his leaders to represent that. And so if they didn't, he was upset. So it's easy to understand why. Just as if you had a mission, you'd want the people under you to understand the mission and represent you. And any time, if you're a leader, anytime somebody does something which doesn't represent your mood or your mission and the way that you deal with people, it's upsetting. You know, just like you know how I deal with devotees. So if I have a leader under me and they don't deal the same way that I deal with them, they're very, let's say they upset devotees, they don't take care of them. Naturally, I'd be upset. So why are you doing this? It's not what I do. So it was the exact same situation here with Tamakrishna Maharaj. So Prabhupada was very upset. And he was, as far as I understand the conversation, Prabhupada was just, for lack of a better word, laying into Tamakrishna Maharaj. So much, and Prabhupada's saying, look at all these devotees are complaining. And it's, you know, if one devotee complains, the Prabhupada would not be so heavy. But if presidents from all around the country are complaining, then that was very concerning to Prabhupada. And so he took it very seriously. And the impression I got is that Prabhupada didn't think it was actually healthy for Tamakrishna Maharaj to be in charge of the party because he had created this problem. And Prabhupada, was, as I said, is very concerned about it. So Prabhupada was very heavy with him. And nothing was resolved. But Tamakrishna Maharaj felt so bad. He just, you know, I think he initially tried to defend himself, but Prabhupada just kept on his point. Because so many people complained, and Tamakrishna Maharaj, I think at a certain point, just admitted that what was happening, whether directly his fault or not, I think he said, well, we're not really preaching that way. No, he did say, he tried to defend himself, and said he wasn't preaching that way, but his men were preaching that way. And the results showed that it wasn't just that they came to a temple and brahmacharis were attracted. The brahmacharis were preaching to them, come on our party, this is where the nectar is. If you stay at the temple, you'll just get married. So he admitted that this was, finally I think he admitted this, that yes. How do we know he admitted it? Because he was so upset with all the complaints and he felt like he had created such a problem that he just, you know, burst out, just out of, how would you say, not, you know, not seriously, but just kind of out of desperation, not knowing what to say or do. He said, well, maybe I should just go to China, I don't know. That created such a problem. You know, like he's just saying, well, maybe you just have to get rid of me because I just created such a problem. So he's feeling really bad. Yeah, maybe, you know, like we used to say, we used to joke with devotees and say, if you don't follow the temple president, if you don't do what we ask you, we'll send you to Siberia. Which is kind of funny because now there's devotees in Siberia. So that was our joke. You know, maybe, you know, I'm so bad, maybe I should go to Siberia. So he said, yeah, I don't know, Prabhupada, what to do. Maybe I should just go to China. You know, it's a total joke. Just out of desperation, you know, maybe I should dig a hole in the ground and hide. Maybe I should go to China. That was the mood. So the next morning, early in the morning, Prabhupada sends his servant and says, bring Tamal. Prabhupada would call him Tamal. Bring Tamal here. And Tamal, Krishna Maharaj, is I've never met anyone in my life as intuitive as him. Within 1 or 2 minutes of meeting him, he figures you out. It's amazing. He understands you. Perhaps even better than you understand yourself. But I've brought people to visit him, people who I knew well, and in 2 minutes, he would talk to them about, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. He totally understood them. It was amazing. He had this kind of intuition I had never seen anyone have. So when Prabhupada's servant came to him and said, Prabhupada wants to see you, I think it was like right after Mangal Arati, he said, no, I'm not going. Can you imagine? Prabhupada asks you to see him and you say, I'm not going. So why did he say that? You know, we have this thing called a Freudian slip. You know, for you say something by accident, you didn't mean it, but actually that's what you were thinking. It just got out. Thank you. So, not actually a Freudian slip, but anyway, Tamakrishna Maharaj understood that when he said, maybe I should go to China, which was just tongue-in-cheek off the top of his head, just an expression, Prabhupada took it seriously. And he had the due intuition. And he's in charge of this biggest book distribution party, right? So he doesn't want to give it up. And I don't think he thought that Prabhupada would ever ask him to give it up. But at this point, he realized that Prabhupada's going to be asking him to go to China. So he said, I'm not going to see Prabhupada. He had that kind of relationship. He was very intimate with Prabhupada. Anyway, the servant said, you have to see him. He's asking you to come. So he basically forces him to come. So, I'm just drinking some water. I'm dehydrated. Hold on. So he brings him into Prabhupada's room, and Prabhupada says, so, you know when you said, maybe I should go to China? And the Prabhupada, I was just kidding. He said, no, Krishna has spoken through you. You should go to China. Now, why am I telling this story and what's significant? So, to me, what's significant is that Prabhupada, he had a principle. And as I said, his principle was that he wanted to keep unity within our movement. And it was very important for him. And he saw now that Smal Krishna Maharaj had done something that was that was already creating factions. And he was so upset with it that he had to do something to stop it because he had to maintain his principle. Yeah. Therefore, he said, you're out. You're no longer, this is no longer your party, and you're going to China. So when Prabhupada said that, he said, but Prabhupada, this is my party, and it depends on me, and we're the biggest book distribution party. So if you know anything about Prabhupada's desire to distribute books, then you know this was his most important program, and he said it many times. This is our most important program, that everything is secondary to book distribution in terms of service. This is like the main preaching. So, understanding that, it seems strange that Prabhupada would take out the man who developed the party, and now the man is saying that the party is not going to continue unless he's in charge. And Prabhupada said, I don't care, I take it away from you. It's not your party anymore. So it had the potential of basically undermining the party, which it eventually did, and the party gradually merged into different temples when Smal Krishna Maharaj was no longer in charge. They went to New York, and then gradually devotees, I think, ended up in different temples. So when I think about this, I think that Prabhupada saw a higher principle, which was to keep unity in the movement, and then he also saw that the mission, we had a mission in communist countries. We had to go there. And Smal Krishna Maharaj would be one of the best, if not the best people to do it. So he was accomplishing a couple of things at the same time. But the point in bringing this up is that Prabhupada was principled, that he would stick to his principles. And that was most important to him. And even at the cost of what would seem, or not even seem, but what was minimizing one of the most important programs in his movement, he kept to his principles. Now, I told you this story. While I was telling you another story. Now, can anyone remember the other story, or the other point I was making before I began this story? Because this was it was meant to emphasize the other point I was making, and I wanted to come back to that point. Unfortunately, I got so into the story I can't remember the other point I was making or the other story I was telling. So I need your help, all of you there, if any of you were paying attention. If you can remember, what was I talking about right before I began telling this story? Because there was another point I wanted to make, which was, I believe the point I was making was something about Prabhupada maintaining principles. Maybe or giving emphasis to principles, which were most important. I don't know if it evolved from the central importance of kirtan in the establishment of all the practices of devotional service. I can't remember. You need to help me. Or we have to. I have to stop and go back and listen to my lecture to remember what I was talking about. This is what happens when you get old. But you're all young, so I'm testing you now. What was I talking about before I told the story? Does anyone remember? Help me. Everybody's sitting there stunned. You've just been tested. Anyway, if you can't tell me, then I'll have to think. We'll have to retrace our steps. We were talking about kirtan as central, and Prabhupada gave central importance to that. I think perhaps what I was saying is that Prabhupada, he knew what was important, and he always stuck to what was important. And he never, not necessarily, what does Krishna Kirtan say, not necessarily big rituals for installation of deities. Oh yeah. So the point I was making is that you would ask why. Yeah, this was the point. I was making the point. And said you might ask if you don't know the whole story. Why would Prabhupada establish all these rituals? Do all these rituals when they're not necessary? And the reason was is because he had to do that in order that people would accept his temple as a bona fide temple. They called it, what did they call the temple, Krishna Kirtan? The Sahib temple? They had a name for that temple. That was called the Sahib means the Westerners. Is that what they called them? Sahib? Krishna Balaram temple was called the Sahib temple. I think. Is that right? But unless the deities were installed according to standards which were accepted by the people of Vrindavan, then they wouldn't accept it as a bona fide temple. So Prabhupada, knowing that, wanted to make sure that this temple would be accepted. So he was willing to do what was necessary, even if the rituals were not according to our Vaishnava standard per se. I mean, there was nothing inherently wrong with them. I don't think they were worshiping demigods. They might have called the demigods for their blessings. I'm not sure. But anyway, so Prabhupada, he understood the essence, he understood what was important. And the point I was making is that Prabhupada's vision was on spreading Krishna consciousness. And so if you ever see a decision he made, which might seem difficult to understand, or maybe even a compromise, as in this situation, if you understand Prabhupada's mind and mood, was to do whatever would help spread Krishna consciousness. Angresi Mandir, Videshi Temple. So Prabhupada was always, you understand Prabhupada's mood and mentality, and then you can better understand why he did things. He was always thinking, Prabhupada was a revolutionary, so really what Prabhupada's most deep thinking was, how to change the whole world, how to make the whole world Krishna conscious, how to change governments, how to change cultures. That's actually what he was thinking. You might think Prabhupada was just establishing temples, making devotees, and writing and distributing books. And so you see the external. But if you go more deeply, and Prabhupada revealed this in different times, he said this. He said, my goal is to create a revolution in the world, to change society. It wasn't Prabhupada's goal, although that may never happen or be possible. Maybe we can only change a few people here and there, but Prabhupada's goal was to change society. He wasn't looking at, well, how many, maybe we could make 100 devotees this year, maybe we could distribute so many books this year. That was, of course, something, those results he was happy with and he did focus on. But below that, he was thinking, we are meant to create a revolution in culture, in society, and change people's lives, and solve the problems that exist in the world and make people happy. And so that's how he was thinking. So there, then any decision he was making, even if it seemed to be externally some kind of compromise, it was based on whatever he could do to further that mission of making people Krishna conscious, he would do that. So that was his principle. And so he would adjust that way. And so the point I was making is that he had his principles and he wouldn't compromise them, and then everything would adjust around those principles. So the story of Tamal Krishna Maharaj was just the principle was unity. And he adjusted at the same time he came up with another preaching plan. So both that he could solve the problem of the factions being created by Tamal Krishna Maharaj and then open up the preaching in China. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was very reluctant to go, and Prabhupada wanted him to go, and he was Tamal Krishna Maharaj. As you can imagine, he developed this party. It took a few years to develop this party, and so it was such an amazing party. 100 brahmacharis or more, 4 Greyhound buses, 20 vans, traveling all across America, just doing phenomenal book distribution. Now Prabhupada's saying, give it up. And so he was very resistant. He was actually arguing with Prabhupada because he had that relationship. That if he didn't think something was right, he would just tell Prabhupada. And in this case, it was about him, and he was extremely resistant. He didn't want to go to China. He didn't want to give up that party. And so he was fighting with Prabhupada. And the way he describes the story is that Prabhupada was very angry. He was really mad. And Prabhupada was so mad, he said, either you go to China, or you sit down here in Mayapur and chant Hare Krishna, which is basically, you have no service. You go to China, or I give you no service. So at that point, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he knew, well, Prabhupada really wants me to go. And in other situations, Prabhupada may ask a devotee to go somewhere, and they would negotiate. Like I said, I really think it's better I do this other service. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj had negotiated before with Prabhupada other services. But this time there was no negotiation. He tried to negotiate, and Prabhupada wouldn't accept it. And that's why Prabhupada said, you go to China, or you have no service. You just sit here in Mayapur. That's it. It's over. So then Tamal Krishna Maharaj got the message. So we're seeing here that Prabhupada was... If you look at Prabhupada's instructions and you look at how he preached, you can understand this principle, that he always knew what was most important in every situation. And so even though it seemed like the installation was a compromise, if you understand Prabhupada's internal mood, you understand it was not a compromise at all. But it was just fit right within Prabhupada's principle. It was his principle, which was to make as many people as Krishna conscious as possible, and in order to do that in Vrindavan, he had to install the deities in this particular way. But at the same time, Prabhupada ordered the devotees to do kirtan. So during this whole installation, they're doing kirtan, and in Prabhupada's mind, that was the real installation. The real installation was the kirtan. So he got the people to accept by doing the ritual. He did the real installation with the kirtan, and therefore he accomplished his goal. So he was always principle-oriented, even if from our perspective it looked like he had compromised principle. We should understand that Prabhupada never compromised principles, ever. But he always understood what the principle was. So what do we learn from this? That we have to understand, well, what's the principle? Then if you understand the principle, you'll never compromise it, because you'll only act to establish it, even if it looks like you've compromised, you haven't. Just like maybe you do something to get the public to chant and dance, and someone might say, oh, you're compromising. But the result, Prabhupada, when someone, let's say, for example, would complain about what another devotee is doing, often Prabhupada would look and say, what's the result? And does the... And there's a saying, the ends justifies the means. So if you got a result, and that result was better than you were getting before, or you couldn't get that result, and the result, if you did something else, and the result was desirable, then Prabhupada would accept it. As long as that means wasn't against regulative principles, or he saw that the means wasn't contaminating the devotees, then he would see that as the principle. And the principle is that it spread Krishna consciousness. So it, if you just look at it and you don't understand the principle, then you might look at the means and say, well, this means is, it's not Krishna conscious. You understand? You say, look at, well, what you're doing is not Krishna conscious. And you say, but let's analyze what it's producing. I'm doing this, it looks like it's not Krishna conscious. But this process has helped us establish 3 temples this year, and this process has made so many devotees. So understanding that this is what my Guru Maharaj wants, then we look at the process in light of, I've understood the principle, which is to establish temples, to distribute books, to make devotees, to engage people in Krishna consciousness, to change society and so forth. I've understood that's the principle. I've taken to these means, and therefore I can say that what we're doing is aligned with the principle. Now sometimes you'll find that people will criticize a preacher because they're looking externally at what he's doing. And Prabhupada was also criticized. One of the things he was criticized for was for allowing women to live in the temple. Of course, they not always lived in the temple. Sometimes they lived in apartments or houses near the temple, but the same idea, that unmarried women were doing service in the temple alongside the brahmacharis. Not exactly alongside, but matter, figure of speech, alongside. So the more orthodox Vaishnavas and Hindus criticized this, because in India they have ashramas. So ashrama, they have mats, they call them mats. There's a little difference between some difference between a mat and a temple. And a temple's for everyone, but a mat is an ashram for men. There's also a temple, but it's a men's ashram. So Prabhupada looked at his temples, not as mats, but as temples. In Prabhupada, he, I think we were saying last in the last class, or the class before, that when this idea came up of single women with children being a burden on the temple, Prabhupada, he didn't mind. He wanted to give them shelter. So Prabhupada's principle, give shelter to everybody, right? That's what he wanted to do. And Prabhupada's principle was print, write, publish, print books as much as possible, and give everyone a chance to become Krishna conscious, man, woman, child, everybody. So because that was Prabhupada's principle, and that's the highest principle of a Vaishnava, Prabhupada let women live in the temple. Now, if somebody criticizes that because they're looking at it and thinking, well, it's not healthy, you have men and women, and it's not a healthy situation. There's a joke, if you have a monastery where the monks live, across the street, you have a convent where the nuns live, so you have the monks living one side, the nuns living the other, and in the middle you have the orphanage. So why do you need an orphanage? Because you have single men, single women, they do their hoochie-coochie, you need an orphanage. That's a joke. One side the monastery, one side the convent, in between the orphanage. So there was that thinking that if you put men and women together, then there's going to be a problem. So there wasn't a problem. There was never a problem because of that. So anyway, analyzing this situation from the perspective of what's the highest ideal? Because Prabhupada, he's always looking at the highest. Prabhupada's always looking at the essence. So if we go to what is the highest ideal, what is the essence, what is the essential principle, and then we base our preaching on these essential principles, so we'll always be doing the right thing. But if we look at what we're doing only in terms of the activity and not understand the principle, then you might say, oh, this is wrong. He's allowing women to live in a temple. So what's the principle? The highest principle, Prabhupada said, of a Vaishnava is compassion. And so compassion means everybody. We allow everybody, right? And so a lower Vaishnava will say, no, don't allow this class of people to come and live in the temple. This is not right and not proper. And they may have their reasons for it. But Prabhupada, as the most merciful, representing Mahaprabhu's mercy, he let everybody come. Hippies, this, whatever your position was, just come. Men, women, it didn't matter. In the early days of the movement, and practically everyone who came was a hippie, and a lot of people came pretty spaced out from drugs, by, you know, almost incoherent. I mean, we've had devotees joined who, when they first came, couldn't really do much. They were just very spaced out from drugs. And today, some of these people are some of our leading preachers. So Prabhupada was allowing all kinds of people to come. And, you know, I'm sure his godbrothers would never have allowed such people to live in a temple, because they were very deranged, some of them. And so that was Prabhupada's mood, let everybody come. So Prabhupada addressed this in the Bhagavatam. He said, I'm criticized for allowing women to live in the temple. Now, the essence of his mission, we said, was to write, publish, and distribute books. And that was an order directly given to him by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. So Prabhupada said, by allowing women to live in the temple, the number of books we distributed has doubled, because there was almost, at least in most temples, there were as many women distributing books as there were men. And a lot of times the women did better in book distribution. And so Prabhupada's looking at what is the essence to allow everyone to engage in devotional service, give everyone the opportunity. That's the compassion of Mahaprabhu. And number two, Prabhupada made another point. He said, even if our principle was not to allow women in the temple, you can't do that in America because it's not the culture. It doesn't work. They're men and women. They're just together. So you're not going to get hundreds and hundreds of brahmacharis and hundreds and hundreds of sannyasis. It's not the culture. So we have to go along with the culture. Men and women are used to being with one another. In the early days of the movement, the men and women just served together. That was just the way the culture was. It didn't bother us, because that's how we grew up. We had so many friends who were girls, not girlfriends, just friends. Which, according to Vedic standards, is weird. How can you have a friend who's a girl? Well, we did, you know. At school, I had so many friends who were girls. I'd see them at school, talk. That was it. I never did anything. So Prabhupada understood this, but Prabhupada's focused on the principle. There's a higher principle at work here, and that's what he's focused on. And based on that principle, he engages us and he spreads his mission. And the result was that he was able to distribute twice the number of books. And that was the essential order of a spiritual master. So from Prabhupada's perspective, he was fulfilling the order of a spiritual master twice as well by allowing women to come, plus fulfilling the order by allowing everyone to engage in devotional service. But if you just look at it externally, it seems like a fault. He's allowing women to live in an ashram, which would be dangerous for the brahmacharis. And it never was dangerous. Nothing ever happened. That wouldn't have happened if the women weren't living in the temple, as far as I saw myself. So we always have to understand what is the principle and stick to our principles. And if it appears that we're compromising, as long as we're not compromising the principle, then we're never compromising, right? There's no such thing as compromise if the principle is not compromised. So Prabhupada's installation of Krishna Balaram was not a compromise of allowing all these Brahmins to do these rituals. It wasn't a compromise because it established the validity, the bona fideness of the Krishna Balaram temple, which was extremely important in Prabhupada's mission, because every Gaudiya Vaishnav movement establishes temples in all the holy places. And so Vrindavan's the most holy. So it was very important that this temple was accepted and acknowledged as bona fide. And Prabhupada did whatever he could to preach to the world that his devotees are bona fide Vaishnavas and Brahmins, because this was always questioned. And if you look at Prabhupada's books, there's so much evidence in his books about devotees being Brahmins and Vaishnavas. So he was supporting us, and that was another principle. And it was really the principle upon which Krishna consciousness has spread. Because even if you spread in India, even the so-called Brahmin families, doesn't mean they have any more qualification than we do. Do Brahmins in this country eat meat? Any Brahmins? Do you know? Yeah, I mean, you don't know. Brahmins, so-called Brahmins could even be, well, eat fish, probably. So and they may have so many bad habits, so it's not that, you know, Brahmins are so great now. So this was another principle that Prabhupada established philosophically, and this is a tattva, a truth in our scripture, that anyone can be raised to the position of Vaishnava. And that's the principle upon which Krishna consciousness is based, because that way Krishna consciousness can go everywhere in the world. And Krishna consciousness is going everywhere in the world, and Prabhupada was making Brahmins, initiating devotees as Vaishnavas. And to only initiate people who are in India or only initiate Brahmins would obviously limit the preaching, and that's not what Mahaprabhu wanted. So Prabhupada, he understood the essence. He always went to the essence. And whenever anyone would question or argue, Prabhupada could always establish why he was doing something based on Shastra or based on a transcendental principle. So the point is, if we study Prabhupada's life and we study Prabhupada's activities, we want to look at it. We want to try to understand when Prabhupada's doing something, why he's doing it, what's the principle, what is the philosophical basis for it that allows what we call the detail. And the detail is just practically how it's going on. You do it this way, I do it that way. What's the principle? What is your way wrong and my way right? Or my way wrong and your way right? It's the principle. And then there's another principle, and I'll read Krishna Kirtan's comment in a minute. There's another principle that goes along with this, and I briefly mentioned it and I want to focus on it because this was an important principle for Prabhupada. And in establishing, in evaluating the effectiveness of anything we were doing, as I said, as we're discussing here, Prabhupada would align it with the principle, and Prabhupada would also judge it by its results, because if we were doing something which may be considered perhaps not externally necessary or perhaps externally something different than we normally do, Prabhupada would acknowledge the validity of it if it produced the results that we wanted. So let's say we decide we're going to wear Western clothes instead of dhoti or sari to distribute books. But if the result is that we're not distributing any more books, or maybe even less books, then Prabhupada would look at it and say, well, why do that if it doesn't have any validity? So sometimes we preach, we meet people, and we're in Western dress. They don't know we're devotees. They don't know who we are, what we are. And we find that we can distribute more books. So we go to Prabhupada and say, in dress this way, I can distribute twice as many books because it's easier to stop people. They don't think I'm a religious preacher. When they see me in a dhoti, they know what I'm doing, and half the people won't stop. And the Prabhupada will say, very good, and continue in this way. Because he saw that the result was greater, and that the result was pleasing to his guru, and the result would spread Krishna consciousness. So then he would look at the means and evaluate the means based on the result and say, okay. But there is another aspect to that, and we told this story before. And the aspect was if you, quote-unquote, compromise your means to produce a greater result, as I'm saying, Prabhupada's okay with that, but what he would look at is, does that means have a negative effect on your consciousness per se? So let's say you switch over from devotee dress to Western dress, and you grow your hair out a little bit, and you're dressing nicely, and all of a sudden you find on Sankirtan that all these women are hanging, you know, after you give them a book, they kind of hang around, and they're like waiting for you to ask them out tonight. And you start to sense that this is becoming more of a problem, because they don't really know who you are and what you are. Whereas in a shaved head and a dhoti, it's kind of clear that you're a monk, and that never happens. So this is a hypothetical example, although this has on occasion happened, and it was not an epidemic, but it did happen. So, but let's say it became an epidemic, where a lot of brahmacharis were falling down because they were wearing Western dress and women were attracted and they were getting allured. And had they worn dhoti and shaved head, it wouldn't have happened. So then if hypothetically that happened, then it would come to Prabhupada and say, Prabhupada, if we dress in Western clothes, we can distribute twice as many books. Prabhupada would say, good. And he said, but what's happening now is, because we're dressing this way, a lot of the brahmacharis are falling down. And Prabhupada would say, then he would say, stop it. Because that's a higher principle. The maintaining our Krishna consciousness is the first and foremost principle. So the point is that if we would do anything that would minimize, compromise our Krishna consciousness, the Prabhupada would say, would stop it. Then I'll tell you a story. I probably told this story before. It's very instructive. There was a program in which devotees were traveling. They had a rock band, and they were traveling with a rock band. It was a really good band. I think as good as any band of the time. And they would travel with this, and they would do festivals. And they would do drama. So it was really good. And Prabhupada came to one of them, and he really liked it. He approved of it. And so their program was from travel from city to city. And there's a group of men and women. I don't know how many devotees was. I wasn't on the program, but I got the impression there was a good group, like 15, 20, 25. It was quite a big party. And they were doing very successful programs. But the energy was on the program, and there was less energy on book distribution and less energy on Harinam Sankirtan. But normally, in those days, this was the early 70s, we travel, we just do books and chant. And so that was a little bit minimized. So that was a concern of some devotees, that we're not doing as much Harinam as we used to do. Still, the programs were very successful, so I think it warranted it. But what was happening is that devotees were doing dramas and play, and the men and the women were spending a lot of time together doing the dramas, interacting with one another, practicing. And as I was told, the story was, it even came to the point where when they were doing the dramas and they had to change costumes, the men and women, there was no facility, they were just changing costumes together in the same place. So it was, in other words, that may not have been the only problem, but that obviously was a problem. It was becoming unhealthy. And it was reported to Prabhupada that, I don't know the details, but apparently there was some concern, and apparently it was affecting devotees. It was seen that their consciousness was getting affected by this arrangement. I don't know how it was presented to Prabhupada, but as far as I could tell, it was presented that this program is bad for devotees' spiritual life. Even though it's good for their Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada stopped it. He said, stop it. Now here's another interesting example. Here's a program, it's successful, but it was harmful spiritually and for the devotees. And this is a very important principle that Prabhupada had. You save yourself first, that's the principle. He stopped the program. Okay, stop it. So, anything we're doing, we want to look at, if we're quote-unquote compromising, not Number one, is the compromise actually producing a better result? Because if you compromise and it doesn't produce a better result, what's the point? Right? You make this big elaborate arrangement, and the end result is nothing better than if you didn't make an elaborate arrangement. And it's like, why did we spend all the money and time? Why do we buy this? Why do we get all the devotees to do all these things? And the end result was nothing better than if we just didn't have all that. That's number one. That's what Prabhupada would look at. And then number two, he would look at how is it affecting you? So, okay, so in this case, the two examples I'm giving, we could justify, apparently justify the means by the ends because we're getting the result. We can say, Prabhupada, here's the result. More people are coming, books are being distributed, devotees are joining, here's the result, we're getting it. And now Prabhupada's saying, what about you? What about, okay, you're wearing Western dress? Prabhupada, it's fine. There's no problem. We're just doing this to distribute books. Everything's good? Fine. No problem. We're dressed respectfully? No problem. People appreciate us. Great. Everything's good. Books are increasing. Prabhupada accepted that. He accepted it completely. You can wear Western dress. Now you come to Prabhupada and say, we're doing this program, but due to the irregulation, due to the intimacy of association men and women, we're finding that the devotees are becoming weak, etc. Stop it. Finished. So that was Prabhupada's principle. So you see how Prabhupada, he always understood the principle, and he would adjust according to the principle. So it's very important for us to know these things, you know, that we do not want to spread Krishna consciousness at the cost of our own Krishna consciousness. Of course, that doesn't make sense, but we've done it. Oftentimes we've worked ourselves to such a point where our sadhana suffered and in the name of preaching. So we don't want to do that. That's stupid. As Prabhupada said, physician, heal thyself. So Prabhupada said, first principle is you save yourself. He said the higher than the principle of saving another person is save yourself. I think the reason is obvious, because who are you going to save if you're in Maya? So that's a very important principle for Prabhupada, that you have to be Krishna conscious to make others Krishna conscious. But at the same time, the principle wasn't just make yourself Krishna conscious and forget about the world. So it was a balance. So Prabhupada always emphasized both of these things. So again, to stress this principle, Prabhupada would always look, what are your results? Was it worth making all these adjustments? Did you actually get a result? And is what you're doing, your method to get the result, is it in any way minimizing your Krishna consciousness? Can you stay Krishna conscious doing it? And so Prabhupada was amazing because he always understood what was the essence of everything, and then he would evaluate it according to that way. Now I'll tell you another story, which I probably also told you, but I think, you know, if you hear a story once, you don't always remember it. So I think it's good that I tell stories over again. And because this is this lecture series is on Prabhupada Leela, then I want to get all these stories in here in one place. So another principle, another illustration of the point of focusing on the principle. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj was in the early 70s. He was a GBC in India, and he's an extremely good manager. So Prabhupada really depended on him, maybe more than anybody in the movement. But after being in India for a while, he was longing to go back to America and preach in America. Because Indians are different. And as an American, he wanted to preach to Americans his age. You know. As an American, Americans think like him. You know, he understands them. And preaching to Indians, especially in the early 70s, it was different. A lot of young people weren't joining. Preaching to older people, basically making life members. And he was also very involved in management. So it was kind of like Prabhupada saw his request to go to America as a request for a vacation. Just like, I need to go and preach and rejuvenate myself. So Prabhupada allowed it. So the idea was, I mean, Prabhupada was reluctant because he depended on him, but he allowed it. So the idea was that he would go to America and he would join Vishnu Janaswamy. And Vishnu Janaswamy had a bus party. And they were old friends, and he would join them, and this was actually the foundation of the Radha Damodar Party. So Vishnu-Jan had maybe 8 men and 1 bus, and then in a couple of years Tamakrishmanash developed it into 6 buses and so many hundreds of men. And all the men he got did not come from the temple. He was making lots of devotees. It was also the biggest devotee-making party, so it was very successful. But anyway, the original idea was that he would go just to get rejuvenated, and then he would come back to India because he was GBC and he was Prabhupada really needed him in India. So anyway, he had gone to America and done his preaching, and he was focusing on making devotees. And the way they did this is they were going from basically college to college, but they would go to public places. And Vishnu-Jan was a very charismatic, mystical kirtan leader, and he had a group, a bhajan band, 3, 4, or 5 devotees, and they would do kirtan. It would attract people. They had a book table, and they also distributed prasadam. And then Tamal Krishnamaj, he would look around and see who was chanting longer, staying with them, who seemed interested, and he would talk to them. And he's a very persuasive person, and he would... His mission was to find people who he could convince to say, come and travel with us for a week. Of course, the intention was that once they came, they would never leave. So he was very good at this, and he was making lots of devotees. And so he had done his preaching for some time, and he had made a fair number of devotees. It was like the best. It was like you couldn't say no to him. He would just like... any excuse you had, he would defeat it. He'd say, why don't you come with us? Well, I have my girlfriend. Oh, she'll be okay, you're only coming for a week, you know. But I have my parents, and just tell them you're going camping. You know, just whatever excuse, he would give it to them. And he would just get them to join him, join the party on the premise that you would just join for a week. And then after a week, they'd want to go. He'd say, well, just stay another week. And why are you going? It's Maya, and what are you going back to? So this is how he would get people. So anyway, Prabhupada came back to America, and he said to Tamal Krishnamurti, say, now, when I go back to India, you come with me. Because the idea was that his stay in America was temporary, and he would come back to India. And he told Prabhupada, but I'm preaching here in America. And Prabhupada sarcastically said, what is that preaching? Because Prabhupada's understanding of him coming to America was that he was preaching more for his own benefit, just to get rejuvenated and preach with his dear friend Vishnu-Jan Swami, and then he would go back to India. So Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada's making this point. You're preaching, so preaching is not sense gratification. You're preaching. What are your results? You tell me you're preaching. Let's see. What is this preaching? So Prabhupada didn't, you know, he thought he was just preaching to rejuvenate himself, and there really weren't any results. So Prabhupada said, what is this preaching? Like, you're making an excuse not to come back and take up your management role on the plea of, I'm preaching. I can't come back, I'm preaching. You know, I'm a big preacher, Prabhupada saying. What is this preaching? So, he said, I'll show you, Prabhupada. And Tamal Krishnamaraj is amazing. He understands everything. And he understood when he was going to ask Prabhupada if he could remain in America and preach, he's going to know, Prabhupada's going to question him. Okay, you want to stay in America and preach? Okay, why? It's like, what's your resume for doing this? He knew Prabhupada was going to put him up against the wall and say, you know, what's your preaching? What do you say? And so Prabhupada did it. He knew it, and he was prepared for it. So what Tamal Krishnamaraj did is he had all the devotees that he had made within that time. Since leaving India, he had them. And he had them all shaved up that day. And he all had them all in brand new dhotis, shining saffron dhotis, tilak, neck beads. So Prabhupada said, what is this preaching? Give me, it's like Prabhupada saying, give me a break, you know. Get back to India, or as we would say in California. Give me a break, dude. Get your butt back to India. So when Prabhupada said, what is this preaching? That's basically the mood. If you're from California, you understand the mood. So then Tamal Krishnamaraj says, oh, I'll show you the results, Prabhupada. And one by one, he brings up all these shaved head brahmacharis. I don't know how many there were, but there had to be a good number, because when Prabhupada saw it, he was beaming, and Prabhupada said, this is preaching. And he said, you stay in America. That interesting? So you can't say I'm preaching. I have this amazing preaching program. It's just so ingenious and so incredible. And say, oh, what are the results? Well, Guru Maharaj, we don't really, I mean, you know, people really like it. Well, make any devotees? Mm. Anybody come to the temple? Mm. Distribute any books? Mm. Not much, not really. But it's a really nice program. Everybody likes it. Everybody's happy. So, okay, that's good. We want people to be happy and like our program. But Prabhupada, you know, he was a practical person. So he's going to look at it. He's going to evaluate. Well, you know, you're doing this program in America, but you could be doing this program in India. And I know what you're going to produce in India. So what are you producing here? If you're not producing anything, get back to India. But as soon as Prabhupada saw the results, then Prabhupada being practical and knowing the essence, he said, this is better than serving me in India. What you're doing here, this is a higher service. Continue. So Prabhupada could do things that way. And sometimes he would see people and he would take them out of positions, which seemed to be very important because he knew they could do something better in another position. So he'd say, you go do this. So again, Prabhupada understanding the essence. So we have to learn from these things. What is the essence? What is the principle? Let me focus on that. So we have two questions, one loaded and one unloaded. Or maybe they're both loaded. Okay, let me put my bulletproof vest on before I read them, the loaded questions, so I don't get killed. You know, every class I give, it goes online, and every class gets put on the series of CD, so I have to be careful about what I say, because it's going around the world. So Krishna Kirtan says, Srila Prabhupada could do that, I'm referring to making adjustments, like women didn't live in temples, to adjusting for the way the deities were installed, making these adjustments, understanding the principle. Prabhupada could do that. But some temple presidents do not have that mature compassion and are not advanced enough to accommodate different kinds of devotees and manage some who are initiated outside ISKCON. Thus they forbid some devotees, to come to the temples or do service because they feel it breaks the internal harmony of the temple life. So how to reconcile between Prabhupada's instructions and current policies in many temples? Well, it's a good question. And one of the things that one has to do when they're a manager in ISKCON is, of course, follow the policies that are given, ISKCON policies which come down from the GBC. At the same time, a temple president should be intelligent enough to know and to understand what is the principle of the policy and whether or not adjustments can be made without violating the principle. And so, you would have to understand something about why the GBC made a resolution that if you are part of another institution, that you should serve in that institution and not serve within ISKCON. And once you understand why they said that, then if you had to adjust the principle on a case-by-case basis, you could better do it. And so the principle, as you mentioned here, was to create internal harmony. If somebody comes from another movement and is critical of ISKCON, or worse, trying to pull people towards their movement or towards their guru, it would create a problem within ISKCON because we're focused on Prabhupada and we have policies. And we have certain philosophical understandings which perhaps the other movement has nuanced understanding which is slightly different, and it would cause disturbance in devotees' minds and create some kind of disharmony. And so the resolution GBC was based on this reality that it was happening. If that had never happened, there wouldn't be a need for a resolution. In other words, if somebody took initiation outside of ISKCON and wanted to serve in ISKCON, and they just came and they adapted and they were totally in line with everything in ISKCON and friendly with the devotees and just like everybody else, there wouldn't have been a need for a resolution that restricted membership in ISKCON to those who are initiated within ISKCON. So it had created problems in some cases in which people were being preached in a way that they became confused. Some different understanding, apparently, from Prabhupada, which the people outside felt was a deeper understanding or clarifying, and the people inside felt it was the wrong or different understanding. Or they saw that it was confusing for devotees, and it created some disharmony. So they made that resolution. Now, having said that, we just had experience. Recently, a devotee has come to Mayapur named Srimati, and I've been talking to her about how to integrate. And she was initiated in Gaudiya Math, but she had also had been associated with ISKCON. But she found that now she is doing better in Mayapur, rather than being in her spiritual master's mat. She finds it's more conducive for her devotional service due to different reasons. And so if you met her, you wouldn't. I mean, she's also taking guidance from me, so she's also well situated in ISKCON. But if you met her, you wouldn't, by talking to her, she wouldn't say anything that would be in any way indicating that she's any different than any devotee in ISKCON. So in that situation, the temple president makes a decision that even though the GBC recommends that if you're initiated outside of ISKCON, you work within that mission, we can make exceptions, because if you can integrate well within ISKCON, then no problem. Come, come, come. Now, I'm saying that as a general principle. Now, every temple president may not say that. Some temple presidents may say, I don't care if they integrate. I don't want them, for whatever reason. Maybe they have bad experience. Or maybe they think, this devotee's nice, but down the road something's going to happen. Or other people from the Gaudiya Math will come to see him, and then they'll say something which will be upsetting. And, you know, different temple presidents may have different reasons. So that's why the principle is there. And if you understand the principle, the principle was to create harmony. But if a person is harmonious within a sangha of devotees, then generally the temple will be okay with them coming and doing service and so forth. But again, it will depend on the temple president. Cultures are different. Some cultures by nature are more conservative, and some cultures by nature are more liberal. So, for example, it generally would be less of a problem in a Western country than it would be in an Asian country. The Asian countries tend to be more strict. This is just general. I'm not saying every Asian temple would be strict or every Western temple would be liberal. It's just a general observation. So I don't know if that's okay. If we go back to understanding what the principle is rather than focusing on the detail, then we can make better decisions. So now Dustin has a loaded question. Is the principle defined differently by different Vaishnavas? No. What problem you have is distinguishing a principle from a detail. If you make a detail a principle, then different Vaishnavas may have different understandings of the principle. But the principle was not the principle, it was actually the detail. So that's where you get into trouble. You know, you make a detail a principle. Detail is we wear Western dress. Then you make that. Principle is wear Western dress. That's the essence. That's the principle. We have to wear Western dress, because if we don't, people will think we're weird or they won't relate to us. So the principle is wear Western. No. The principle is get people to relate to you and accept you. And the detail is what color shirt you wear, where you preach to them, how you comb your hair. This is all detail. Do you wear tilak? Don't you wear tilak? Do you wear dhoti? Those are details, not principles. So it brings up a question I had about a topic like the holy festival in the U.S. I've heard some concerns about chanting the holy names in that type of venue. Do you think Srila Prabhupada would have any issues as some others might? Off the top of my head, I don't think he would, but I've never been to a holy festival, so I don't know. Again, my My general feeling is, if I could write a letter to Prabhupada and say, Prabhupada, 30,000 people came and chanted Hare Krishna, and we had a holy festival, and they all bought dye, and we made $500,000, and with this money, we're building a new temple in Salt Lake City. I can't imagine Prabhupada saying, I'm very unhappy with that. Why did you do that? It just doesn't, I can only think Prabhupada saying, I'm so happy, you're so intelligent, this is wonderful. Continue. You know, you have Prabhupada going, doing the mantra rock concert, and so all these bands were playing and people were chanting Hare Krishna. And I think, from what I understand of Prabhupada is it, let's say you make this elaborate arrangement, right? So Chiru Prabhu makes this elaborate arrangement and he gets all these people chanting Hare Krishna and all these people giving money to him. And my question would be, if anyone criticizes that, is that, can you produce that result doing it a different way? Can you get 30,000 people to chant Hare Krishna if you do it a different way? Is that possible? And the answer is no, then you don't. I don't think you really have a good argument. If nobody felt, you know, the other principle, if the end result of the devotees are Krishna conscious, all right, so you have a rock and roll band. Do you need a rock and roll band to get 30,000 20-year-olds to chant Hare Krishna in America? Well, the only thing I can say is nobody's done it without a rock and roll band, and nobody's done it without the holy festival. So the answer would appear to be, yes, that's what you need. Now, Prabhupada's point would be that if you criticize that and say you don't need to do that, Prabhupada would say, well, do it without it. And then if you got, you know, 30,000 people to come and chant Hare Krishna and together they gave you $500,000 and you just did it based on come for a kirtan mela and take prasad and we're going to chant all day, hey, everyone would say, look at that. You don't even need to throw powder, you don't need to throw away the electric guitars, burn the drums. You don't have a fire sacrifice, throw the cymbals in there, throw your amplifiers in there, you don't need it. But until somebody can show that, it's hard to make the argument that you did something wrong, even though you got 30,000 people chanting Hare Krishna, and you made all this money. I would just think, Prabhupada would think, this man is, and his wife are fantastic. They're super intelligent and energetic, and look what they've done. That would be my response. And you got a large group of people chanting Hare Krishna, a large group of people giving money, and really positive influence on society in general. The festival is appreciated. Okay, so you might say, well, it's just a holy festival and it's a compromise. But you have to look at the result. And any professional company is going to look at the result, isn't it? Okay, we have this marketing campaign. Now we're rolling out this new product, you know, Coca-Cola. What do they call it? Coca-Cola. They had this new Coca, what, new Coke or something, you know. They came out with some Coca-Cola, you know, the new Coke was supposed to be like the better Coke. You know, it was like 8 years ago or something. And they had cherry Coke, this Coke, you know. So they came out with some new Coke, which was supposed to be the upgraded version of the traditional Coca-Cola, and it didn't work. So they just took it off the market. So, you know, that's what you have to do. You know, did it work? If it didn't work, take it off the market. Forget it. Why do it? Why bother? You know, we thought it would work this way and it didn't. And we're wasting our energy. Let's put our energy into something that works better. Now, if you, Dustin, do your Colors Festival, and year after year after year, it doesn't grow, you put out tremendous amount of energy, you barely break even, or you even lose money. And, you know, the first year you got 2,000, the next year you got 1,000, next year you got 500. You know, then obviously you're going to say, well, why, you know, I could get more devotees. Just, you know, if we just do a Rath Yatra, we can get that many people. So then, you know, you might sit at a meeting and say, well, look, why don't we just do Rath Yatra? We can get the same number of people and it's more direct. It's a direct Krishna conscious program. And everyone will say, yeah, that makes sense. You know, if If we're doing the Colors Festival, which seems to be just a platform to attract people, but it's not attracting more people, then why are we doing it? There's no, you know, and a person might say, that's true, but it's another festival. So we could have Rath Yatra and we could have Color Festival. So you could have two festivals a year, rather, why just have one? And you might say, okay, we need to have a different festival. Then some might say, well, why do a Colors Festival? Why don't you do a different festival? It would be this festival. If we, why don't we do a festival for children? And we'll have children do this or that, and all the parents will, oh, that's a good idea. So, you know, you figure out what's best. You consider everything. Coca-Cola Life, is that what they call it? What do they say? What's that expression, Coca-Cola? Get real or something? Is that their ad, Get Real? Used to be their ad. Now they advertise in Mexico, Coca-Cola is healthy. They have a new one, you know. Coca-Cola, well, yeah, before they had, no, this is before they had Coca-Cola Life. It was like Coca-Cola new, anyway. So we're like Coca-Cola. We're trying to see, you know. Okay, let's, the holy name is the product. How do we package it? Do we package it this way? Do we package it that way? What's the goal? We want to get people to chant Hare Krishna, so. Okay, so we're going to end here. I have to chant Yappa, Yappa Yappa. So, thank you for listening. I hope this clarifies a little more about Prabhupada's focus on essence. And we will see you. Well, I don't know if we're going to see you. Because next Saturday at this time I'm giving a class. We're doing a workshop in Faridabad on vows. So, and Guru Nisha says, Guru Maharaj, can you broadcast it? And Guru Maharaj says, I don't know if they have internet. And I don't even know if I'll remember to broadcast it. So anyway, we'll work it out. Guru Nisha and I will work it out, and maybe we would adjust the time we give class. And then we'll go from there. We'll let you know. Because my class starts at 4:30, and normally Indian time is 6 in the evening. On Saturday, I give class. And I can also, I mean, I could find out if there's internet. And sometimes there is internet, but just happens that the moment I get there, it doesn't work. Or it works when I get there, and then it stops working, because it's India. So if I say I'm going to broadcast it, I can't guarantee that. And the devotee who knows why the internet is working had to go home just a minute ago because his daughter is sick. And this is like, you think I'm making this up? No, it happens all the time. So I can't guarantee there's any internet. So, and I can't guarantee the way the sound system sets up and I walk around that you're even going to hear me that well. But anyway, thank you for listening, and we'll keep you informed about the next class. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, go premanandi hari hari bol.